Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning into our award-winning For the People, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Well, the Connecticut State Water Plan was developed by the Water Planning Council and its chairman, John Betkoski, to balance the needs of public water supply, economic development, recreation, and environmental health. So we're going to check in with Commissioner Betkoski to learn why all state residents should be encouraging their state reps and senators to take up a review of this groundbreaking public initiative when they convene again this fall. Then we're going to learn how Norwalk Hospital's emergency department has reduced the amount of opioids they are ordering and providing for patients by nearly half, and the lessons that all medical providers prescribing opioids can take from Norwalk Hospital's ER docs. Then we're going to close touching base with the Connecticut Business Leadership Network upon completion of their fourth installment of the Inclusion Works Here series, helping state employers learn how to successfully support those with mental health in their workplace. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder. No matter where you are in Connecticut, our longtime friends at My Sister's Place have launched a one-of-a-kind online thrift store dedicated to supporting victims of domestic violence and their families. On average, 24 people per minute survive rape, physical violence, or stalking by an intimate partner in the United States. You can help fight the battle against domestic violence by patronizing or donating to My Sister's Place, operating for more than three decades and providing a destination for folks looking to get in on some awesome deals while dealing a blow against domestic violence. If you'd like to order, make a donation, or find out more, just click on supportumbrella.org. Well, we're welcoming a longtime resource and great friend to the program back this morning. John Betkoski, we call him Jack, is vice chair of Connecticut's PURA, the Public Utility Regulatory Authority, and chairman of the State Water Planning Council. This year, he's also honored to be president of the National Association of Regulatory Commissioners. And we are here picking up on a conversation that we left off late last year about the new Connecticut water plan. The governor about 3 weeks ago signed an executive order directing the state's water planning council to immediately implement the state water plan that was submitted to the General Assembly back in January. This was ordered under Public Act and was developed by the WPC to balance the needs of public water supply, economic development, recreation, and ecological and environmental health. And we talked a lot about this in concept, Jack, as we spoke the last time, which was basically sending out a message to all the folks in Connecticut that it was a kind of a use it or lose it in terms of their opportunity to comment on things that they wanted to see from the water plan. So looking back on that period, tell me a little bit about your level of satisfaction and the diversity of the input that you got thanks to both these public forums that traveled around the state and this period of public input.
Well, John, the great thing about this was that because of programs like yours, we were ready to get out and to reach people. We had about 36 public events and presentations statewide. We had three regional public information meetings, two that we had with Representative Hampton from Simsbury and Representative Mashinsky from Wallingford and Representative Steinberg from Westport. And then we had a large public hearing last year on it. And it was able to get people from the business community, from citizen-led coalitions, environmental advocacy groups, members of the public, municipal officials, state agencies, legislators, and water suppliers to come and to be part of the process. I mean, as you know, this is the final report is over 600 pages. Mm. So we wanted to be sure to give everyone an opportunity to be included in looking at the science, looking at the public engagement of it, the ecological and environmental needs of the public, and most importantly, public health and safety.
Mm-hmm. So the legislative review and approval of the plan did not happen. The initiation of it by executive order did. What does that mean?
That's a great question. What has happened? The last stop in this very long journey was to the state legislators' committees of cognizance, which would be public health, environment, energy, planning and development. And they were supposed to look at it and ultimately approve it. And there was a big debate over the, there was incorporated in two or three places in the
report, in the 600 pages.
Two or three points. There, we mentioned public trust and was basically regurgitating something that happened in like the early 70s when the initial Environment Protection Agency for the state was being formed, that public trust was, in, when it comes to environment, was people have a right to for water, air, a clean, green environment. And that's really what was in that particular statute. And what we did is we cited that in our report to make sure that people were aware of it. And that created a great deal of debate in terms of what it actually, and you can ask six different lawyers their interpretation and you get six different answers.
Mm. From your perspective, as you kind of walk along this razor's edge pinnacle between those who would advocate on behalf of the public trust and the regulated water companies that operate in Connecticut under PURA, what were some of the things that you were hearing from the water companies?
I think what was the issue was really when it comes to the oversight of the water supply, who has the authority to say what companies can do with their water supply, and who, if you had this public trust, would it mean that when a company wanted to, for example, open a bottling plant or something like that, who would have the oversight? And water, as a utility, is the most heavily regulated water utility we have. It's regulated by Public Utility Regulatory Authority. It's regulated by the Department of Public Health, Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. So these issues that were coming forth are issues that I'm very optimistic with the governor's executive order, because he's telling us to carry on with the implementation of the program. But to submit the report, to say we're not going to change the report. We're going to submit the same report to the legislature next year. And hopefully by that time, we'll be able to diffuse some of the debate. Everybody hats off to all the people that are part of this process, the environmental advocates, the Save Our Water people, the good stewards for the environment. But the water companies are also good stewards for the environment. So I just think we have a little bit of a misinterpretation to debate in this, but I'm optimistic we'll reach consensus by the end of the year.
Well, I think it's important to assert here, too, that while the ultimate cost falls on the ratepayers, we have heard on this program before from several sources that, the water companies, which are so heavily regulated by this trinity of DEEP, DPH, PURA, and some federal agencies too, right? I mean, there's some federal oversight on water as well. So it goes far beyond just what happens within the confines of the state of Connecticut when it comes to water companies operating in Connecticut. But these companies are responsible for, and it appears are motivated to ensure that their mechanics and infrastructure and sites are well protected and to the degree that it can be on the cutting edge of being operational from a mechanical infrastructure standpoint, state of the art.
John, you're absolutely right. I mean, and I'm glad you pointed that out, because not only are they heavily regulated by the state, you have federal EPA guidelines that need to be adhered to, and as I said, the health and safety of our water supply is of utmost importance to everyone. That's why we're constantly upgrading filtration plants. We're upgrading our infrastructure system. We're looking at ways to make sure that people continue to have a free flow of potable water within the state of Connecticut. And it's used, as you said earlier in your introduction. I mean, it's the only utility we ingest. We can't live without it. It's used for economic development. It's used for recreational. It's used for environmental. So the list goes on and on and on. But that being said, we need to, you know, make sure that we don't get just haphazard about the oversight of the water supply.
Going back to the legislative approval, does the lack of that in the interim between when the executive order was signed and the eventual looking at it, that, I mean, they have to take this up next session, right? They don't have an option to just let it go by executive action, right?
No, they have to take it. I mean, it would be much nicer if we had had this approval going into the next several months. But yes, it's got to be taken up again. And I think that, you know, this will give us an opportunity to hopefully get by some of the questions people have about this whole public trust issue, so that any type of apprehensions people may have about it, we can address. We're all people that really, for the most part, I think everybody really wants this water plan to be passed, and it'd be one, the first one in New England. It'd be one about 20 in the United States, and you know, Connecticut's very much at the forefront, as you indicated in my intro, that I'm very involved in national regulatory work, and Connecticut has been very far ahead of some of the other states in terms of what we've done in terms of protecting and maintaining our water supply.
Yeah, I imagine when you're interacting with your national colleagues on the National Association of Regulatory Commissioners, more than a few have said, hey, the minute that 600-page document comes out, you send me a PDF because our state wants to look at that.
You're absolutely right, John. You're absolutely right. That's happened to me more than once. People want a copy of it because they're trying to do the same thing in their respective states.
Right. Well, in the last 3 or 4 minutes that we have with you, Commissioner Bukowski, let's talk about going forward with or without legislative approval. This is not just something that the executive order was signed and boom, it goes onto the shelf. There is a directive to either continue working with or reform some sort of advisory group, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The Water Plans Council Advice Group is a statutory group, basically made up of stakeholders that are involved in the water industry. And they're going to be very much, as a matter of fact, they're going to be part of the implementation committee. We're going to be really leaning heavily on them in terms of with their education and their insight and their experience to help us make this plan a reality. So we want to make sure to address some of the issues people have. We want to make sure this is a very inclusive group. So, and it's set up statutorily by who should be in it. So I'm very optimistic. We have a great cross-section of people throughout the state of Connecticut that are part of that group.
Obviously, citizens can play a very active role beginning the minute they hear this program, in getting on their email, getting on their phone, looking up their state senators and state representatives to implore them to expedite taking up the review of the state water plan as soon as the next session convenes. But can the same citizens do anything in terms of supporting this this implementation council?
Yes, absolutely. And I always like to get our website, www.ct.gov/water. And that's www.ct.gov/water, so people can see when our meetings are, when our deadlines are. Our meetings are always open to the public. We have public comment. They can write letters, they can send emails, and they can keep their respective legislators and senators apprised of the process and support the plan.
So there will still be public comment on the implementation now that the executive order is signed?
Correct. We are right. Our meetings are always anything people would like to say at our meetings publicly. We make them part of the transcript and part of the record.
Mm-hmm. Very good. In the last minute or so that we have with you, Jack, we're coming into a wicked hot week as we tape this on the first weekend of July. How are we looking? Do we have a statewide restriction now going on water?
No, thank goodness. Not thank goodness. No, and so far we're okay, but we're constantly monitoring our water supply between the respective agencies, health, environment, and ours, to make sure that we have an adequate water supply. But just like with our electricity, we'd ask with our water, we ask people, you know, don't be washing your car three times a week when it gets like this, because if we have a hot spell like this, you and I have both lived through the drought situation, so we can't take the water for granted. So we just have to be very conscious of how we utilize our water.
Very good. Well, as always, Jack, you know, going back to your days as a state rep, you've been a great resource to this program and a huge resource to the state of Connecticut, doing us proud by being elevated to the position of president of the National Association of Regulatory Commissioners. In fact, all the others in the United States this year are looking to you for leadership, and they're getting it as vice chair of PURA, Connecticut's public utility regulatory body, and chair of the State Water Planning Council, wearing a lot of hats, but really appears that there's great leadership going on. So we appreciate all that you're doing, and thank you for this touch base on this new Connecticut water plan, which is now in place. Folks, write and call and email your legislators. Tell them first thing the next session they need to review the state water plan. Well, so many of our segments over the past few years have been not so great news when it comes to Connecticut's opioid epidemic, that when I received the press release from Western Connecticut Health Network about some incredible news out of Norwalk Hospital, I couldn't wait to share it, and I'm sharing it with a couple of very, very worthy guests this morning. My guests are Dr. Ben Greenblatt. He's chair of emergency medicine at Norwalk Hospital, and Dr. Christopher Mikos, who's an emergency medicine doctor at Norwalk Hospital. And we're going to talk about the opioid crisis and how Norwalk Hospital is addressing the issue through innovative strategies that substantially decreased opioid ordering by physicians in the Bauer Emergency Care Center. So, gentlemen, welcome in advance. Thank you so much for the roles that you're playing in this important work. So, obviously, for years, Connecticut and the nation has been in the grip of this opioid epidemic. So let's start talking about what you guys have been seeing from the front lines in the emergency department at Norwalk Hospital in terms of how things are going with patients that are coming through your doors.
Thanks, Sean. Thanks. This is Dr. Greenblatt. Thanks for having us this morning. Like many EDs throughout the country, you know, we're seeing patients arrive, with either acute overdoses, or we're discovering they have addiction problems, while they're in the emergency department for other reasons. So, you know, there is an acute need, for addressing the issue. There's multiple different ways to do this. Our approach, was really to try to look at the supply and demand aspect. Fortunately, Dr. Mikos is very passionate about the issue, and he was just the right person to help lead the initiative in our emergency department. Chris, did you want to mention anything about your interests?
Well, yes. I mean, Dr. Greenblatt has said, we're on the front lines, and I don't think a day goes by that you don't see something in the press about the opioid epidemic and the crisis that the United States is facing. We saw it in our emergency room with numerous overdoses and, unfortunately, deaths from opioid use in our community. So it really is a very important aspect to me and our facility, and through Dr. Greenblatt's support, we were able to look at this from a practice perspective and try to determine what we can do. Andrea knows that I speak of some statistics. I mean, in 2016, there were 64,000 deaths in the United States, with 75% of them involving opioids. And every day, 91 Americans die from opioid overdoses every day. So this is a serious health crisis. It's an epidemic in the United States. And even in the first 2 months of this year, in January and February, there were over 1,300 visits to Connecticut emergency departments for overdoses. So this is something that we see every day. And certainly, we felt very strongly that we needed to try to implement some programs and some initiatives to try to combat what we're seeing on the front lines.
Well, I'm glad you brought that that number up, Chris, because 1,320 drug-related emergency department visits since January 1st of this year. After something of a leveling off of the spike in the previous year, going off script here kind of for a moment, could either of you speak to your thoughts on whether or not you think that kind of tide coming back in a little bit is related to the shift to the to fentanyl for the drug users?
Yeah, I think you're right. There has been a leveling off from the prescribing aspect of it, and unfortunately, what we have not seen is any decreasing deaths from usage. So you're right; they're getting it either off the internet or off the street, and they're using either fentanyl, or heroin, or any of the other synthetic opiates. So it's an unfortunate problem that I think it's going to be hard to sort of put back in the box, but we've not seen the decrease in leveling off in deaths with the leveling off from the prescriber's point of view.
I see. Okay. Well, Western Connecticut Health Network continues to commit resources to individuals suffering from mental health and substance abuse issues. We hear so much on this show from folks who are our guests from the mental health world, folks providing care and therapies and locations for individuals suffering from mental health issues. Of note is a new and innovative pain management program that you folks have instituted at Norwalk Hospital that's designed to reduce opioid ordering by physicians in the emergency care center. And this is the first program of its kind in the state of Connecticut. So can we kind of walk back to the formative days when this idea was introduced and this goal was kind of, gauntlet, if you will, was kind of thrown down to make such a substantial difference so quickly in the amount of opioids that Norwalk Hospital is consuming for its patients?
Sure. This is Chris Mikos. Again, as we were seeing the evidence in the press and also in our emergency department, we took an effort to try to cut back our opioid use. And in collaboration with one of our nurse champions, our Department of Pharmacy, myself, and with Dr. Greenblatt, we looked at the literature. We looked at what was being practiced and decided that there were definitely literature and evidence-based supported protocols for new and more innovative types of therapies to try to reduce immediate opioid use for the for pain control. Let me first by saying that we have an understanding and belief that certainly opioids do play a role in those patients that are seriously injured and also those that are suffering from serious and catastrophic illnesses where pain relief is both important and also medically necessary. So we're not completely reducing, we're not completely eliminating it, but we are looking to newer types of therapies, and there's new protocols out there, specifically the introduction of intravenous lidocaine as a pain relief non-opioid use. So we develop protocols. We develop what we call care sets, which are part of our electronic medical record protocol ordering system. We also had education and heightened awareness among our fine emergency staff, our physician assistants, and nurses. And we created a new culture to try to use newer protocols, newer types of medications, newer type of procedures to both eliminate opioid use but also treat our patients and develop a benefit for them, and also try to cut back on the risk of addiction or developing patients being addicted to opioids. There's a lot, some research out there that says that the acetaminophen or Tylenol and ibuprofen or Motrin or Advil can be just as effective as using a narcotic. So this is some of the literature and some of the information that we reviewed in our department and started implementing in our emergency department.
We've hit the midpoint of the program, so we're going to get right back to the two docs here at Norwalk Hospital to talk about these excellent advances in reducing their consumption of opioids. Stick with us. We'll be back in just a moment. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Experienced Core Needs volunteers ages 50 and over to tutor literacy in participating Hamden, New Haven, and East Haven schools and after-school programs with children in kindergarten to grade 3. Volunteers tutor two mornings or two afternoons weekly, an average of about 6 hours a week, at one site from October to June. The Experienced Core provides the training, you provide the love. To learn more, attend one of the upcoming volunteer information meetings happening over the next few weeks. You could call 203-752-3029 to learn more, or just visit the Agency on Aging of South Central Connecticut at aoascc.org. And speaking of literacy, Literacy Volunteers' annual Neon Night Run is going to be held behind the Milford Public Library in downtown Milford Saturday, July 14th. This luminescent neon night race will convene at the Rotary Pavilion at 6:30 for registration, with the main event stepping off at 8. Registration is just $35, and children under 5 are free. The first 250 online registrants are going to receive a free neon t-shirt, glow necklace, and more for being proactive in helping raise funds in support of the center's vital literacy programs for hundreds of local adults and children in need. All you need to do is register by visiting lvsct.org. Thanks for sticking with us. We're back with the docs from Norwalk Hospital. Now, Chris, you know, it's one thing to organically see a culture shift happen in an institution as large as Norwalk Hospital, but when it is sort of pushed or suggested, sometimes it's a little bit more difficult to implement. But it really sounds like, for obvious reasons, your entire ED staff, if not most, if not virtually all the staff at Norwalk Hospital, was on board with this initiative and willing to pitch in and help wherever they could. And I understand there was a colleague nurse who played a really critical role in getting this whole thing off the ground.
Correct, and that's what I try to mention. We had a nurse champion involved in this. And again, you're right. It takes time to change culture, but when you present the literature, and when you have a collaboration with all of the providers, all of the nurses, the staff, pharmacy, it creates an improved and new culture. And this is, this is a top-down thing from our leadership and Dr. Greenblatt, who is very involved in this and very instrumental, going all the way down to all of our providers and nurses. It's education, it's training, it's reevaluation, and also what's very important is data, making sure that you can measure the improvement. And that's how we generated the data, that we were reducing the percentage of opioid ordering to the level of 45%. So it does take a team effort. I wish I could say that I was the sole provider of this, but we had nursing, we had pharmacy, we had leadership. We had education, we had evidence-based information and literature, and also we had the concern and interest of our team, because we were seeing it of what was going on in our neighborhood as well as the nation.
Very good. Folks, go ahead, Ben. Sorry.
I think I was just going to, add to that. I think, Dr. Michaels is correct. You know, there's really anybody that's thinking of doing this, I've gotten you know, emails and a phone call about other institutions in Connecticut and as far away as Virginia, people are interested in doing something like this. But, you know, this is a multidisciplinary effort, as Dr. Mikus was just saying. So really, you know, from IT working with us to get us the data to help create, you know, a care set in the electronic medical record that makes it easy to, you know, working with the nurses and our physicians and physician assistants, and, you know, really the amount of, you know, education and, you know, in every meeting, you know, we had staff meeting, you know, Dr. Mikus presented, you know, information. Chris, I think you were out in New Jersey to go at a hospital there that was doing some innovative work. And, you know, really is bringing it back and constantly putting it out there. It also helps that it's just in the news, whether it's on television or in the newspaper, it's just all over the place. So it really aligned nicely, and we were able to show the data of how it started to actually come down month by month.
And aside from the coordination among the staff, these four important components of the initiative, you guys were also really brilliant at Norwalk Hospital in tapping and maximizing the cutting edge technology that was available to you, particularly this ultrasound guided peripheral nerve blocking. Let's talk for a few moments about that.
Sure. You know, so the, you know, that's one, you know, that's one aspect of it. You know, certainly medications, you know, so where possible, you know, for example, I'll use an example of hip fractures. You know, if hip fractures and typically happen in elderly people, you know, elderly people that get opiates tend to stay in hospital longer, tend to have, you know, longer lengths of stay, some complications, some delirium perhaps. So any ability to sort of, you know, anesthetize the area with ultrasound was an opportunity to decrease opiates in that population. So again, working again with, you know, anesthesia, who routinely does this, you know, we were able to, you know, come down through a teaching session during our staff meetings. A couple of the docs are, you know, very proficient, you know, with ultrasound, and really started teaching it. But, you know, that was not the only area, you know, so this was something that we could do with shoulders and ankles and other areas. And that would, you know, one is, you know, is actually quicker than actually ordering the narcotic. And the other thing, you didn't get a lot of the side effects from the narcotics, and you could really get excellent pain management at the site that you're interested in.
Very good. Before we let you gentlemen go, there's another component we wanted to talk about here, and that is the addressing the unmet mental health needs. And I understand this is tied to the prescribing practices that have now reduced Norwalk Hospital's utilization of opioid medication by 45%. Let's just talk a little bit about how you guys are working on that end.
Well, I just want to clarify that, you know, so this was, you know, from the ordering in the emergency department of opiates. You know, we're looking into the prescribing aspect. We suspect that that's also been impacted. That's going to be a little, you know, that's some work that we're having to work with IT with. That's a little bit harder to get that information, but you know, we do work with the community care team, the network. Has a community care team that's also multidisciplinary, a team made up of social workers, psychiatrists, psychologists, and the ED in the emergency department. And we work to identify patients that come to the emergency department, not just necessarily for, you know, opiate problems, but anybody with a lot of social needs, mental illness, and we try to give them the services that they need, whether it's, you know, insurance, or whether it's getting them in to see, you know, a psychiatrist, whether they're homeless and they need housing. So it's really a team that works. So when we try to sort of work with these other social aspects, psychosocial aspects of these patients' care to decrease their emergency department visits. And that's been a very successful program in itself in decreasing visits to the emergency department. But certainly anybody with polysubstance abuse or opiate abuse gets identified there, and they can get resources, either rehab or other setup
intervention.
And
I just wanted to clarify for our listeners' edification, I may have spoken too broadly. We are talking about Norwalk Hospital's 45% reduction in opioid ordering in the emergency department in the first year of a new program between 2016 and 17. So not to speak generally about the entire institution there, but it cannot be minimized that it's not only the first effort of its kind in the state of Connecticut, but I imagine one that is already being looked at very, very acutely by not only other hospitals and hospital systems in Connecticut, but perhaps even, I would imagine, across the country, right?
Sure. Chris, I think you had some experience with a hospital in New Jersey, right?
Yes. There is another hospital in New Jersey that's also very involved in this program of trying to reduce opioid use and also finding alternative therapies. So, we've been in communication with them. We've tried to collaborate, and this is a process that I think that all emergency departments should be thinking about and how to minimize. Certainly, the state of Connecticut has the prescription monitoring program that we use, and other hospitals in the state of Connecticut have to use, as well as other prescription prescribing programs in the United States. It's certainly something that's definitely on the radar. I hate to be a statistic type of person, but you know, the opioid epidemic has actually impacted the U.S. life expectancy, causing a decrease for the first time. So here, as physicians and healthcare providers, we're actually improving our life expectancy. Opioid abuse has created a decrease for the first time in a number of years. So it is a partnership that we have with all emergency departments to try to curb this crisis and also find alternatives to treating acute pain in our facilities.
Folks, if you'd like to learn more about the great work that's being done at Western Connecticut Health Network and by our guests at Norwalk Hospital, you can go to WCHN.org. Our guests this morning are Dr. Ben Greenblatt, who's chair of the Emergency Medical Department at Norwalk Hospital, and Dr. Chris Mikos, who's also an emergency physician. Great work on your part, doctors, and I look forward to speaking with you again and the folks at Western Connecticut Health Network as you take these numbers up significantly higher, I imagine. We'll be seeing that in the coming months and years. So thank you very much for your great work, and thanks for being part of the program. Well, when we first heard about the Connecticut Business Leadership Network holding reoccurring meetings about mental health in the workplace, we made a commitment to their executive director, Sharon Denson, who's an attorney, and we promised that we would return to speak with them and keep caught up and sort of be a venue for which they could share with business owners throughout the state of Connecticut and our entire listening area, as well as where anyone's listening to our podcasts on iTunes or on our radio station websites, about the important work they're doing, dare I say groundbreaking work here in Connecticut. Their latest session was June 21st up in Berlin, Connecticut, in their series on mental health in the workplace. So without further ado, let's bring Sharon Denson onto the line. Good morning, Sharon. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Good to be here.
So we have been talking to you. I think this is our third visit so far as you put these sessions up. So just to refresh and remind our listeners, can we go back to the before the beginnings of this effort to talk a little bit about the formative stages of putting this series together?
Well, we felt that it was very important as part of our initiative to create more inclusive workplaces to address mental health issues. There's a great deal of stigma around mental health and mental health and mental health disabilities, even more so than there are about more visible and physical disabilities. It is important to address these issues, and the importance came at us and hit us really, really hard when we learned about the suicides of two very well-known people, Kate Spade and Anthony Bourdain. And this makes us really think about what can be the ultimate bad outcome if mental health issues are not addressed.
Yeah, sadly, the loss of Kate Spade and Anthony Bourdain sort of put an exclamation point, if you will, on a really, really disturbing statistical rise in suicide deaths, and sadly, an exponentially increasing rate, increasing rate among middle-aged women, where this was predominantly looked upon as more of a man's issue before, in terms of the proportions of suicide between men and women. So this was really the right event at the right time. And I understand that you really had some stimulating and engaging conversations. Let's talk about first, the logistics of the event. Who did you have a panel discussion? How did that all set up?
Well, we had a speaker, Deborah DeSantis Lozier, who is a mental health expert and is able to give or has the certification to give mental health first aid trainings. And mental health first aid is a program where the people who are involved in the program are trained to assist individuals who are going through a mental health crisis.
Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about some of the questions that were presented to Deborah from the audience and some of the concerns maybe that were presented so that folks that are listening that may be involved in HR or with businesses can hear that kind of empathy or that commonality of questions that they themselves may have.
Well, first of all, you used two really important words, empathy and commonality. When we address issues of mental health, we address diversity and inclusion issues, what we're really talking about is creating a community within our workplaces and an open community. And this was really, if you could think about the outcome or the message we wanted to get across through this meeting, it was that that individuals who end up in a mental health crisis or end up hurting themselves or maybe other people are people who felt a sense of disconnection. And that's something that's common if we look at all of these situations that is common to all of them. So then the question becomes, and this was the question that was asked most, and we hopefully came up with some answers through Deborah, was how do we create a connection to everybody in our organization so that individuals feel they are part of the whole and they don't feel disconnected?
It's sad to say that when suicide occurs, it impacts the obviously the immediate and extended family of the individual, but also the coworkers and the community of their workplace. Was this something that was touched upon by your speaker at all in terms of maybe better equipping your guests at this latest event to respond appropriately to the surviving workforce when someone in their work community sadly takes their own life?
Yes, this was brought up. We really had not initially decided to talk about suicide prevention and the aftermath of a suicide. It came up and came up really large. It was going to be part of our presentation because of the timing. As you said, this is, two very, very sad events, and they happened within a day of my sending out our first invitation to this meeting, and it made the meeting that much more relevant. Yes, we did address that, and what we focused on was prevention. Mm-hmm. If that's possible, how do you prevent something like this from happening within your community. And also the reality is that it may not be possible to prevent it. So if it doesn't happen, people do not blame themselves for it happening.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to have both, you have to look at both sides of that. But prevention is really important, and that's what we spoke about. We spoke about having a mental health friendly community, a mental health friendly and inclusive workplace.
And, go ahead, I'm sorry.
And so that people who are having issues feel comfortable reaching out to their supervisor or a coworker, et cetera, that type of thing. Deborah had spoken to us about seeing a woman in her at her workplace who was crying in the ladies' room. And she talked about approaching her and just asking, is everything all right? And she ended up having a connection with this individual and was able to help her. Now, Deborah is a professional in this area, but you don't have to be a professional in order to help someone. Just caring and asking, is everything all right, that may be enough to help an individual and help them look at their situation and maybe even go ask for professional help.
Mm-hmm.
But if we ignore our colleagues and we don't ask, then we will, you know, never get that opportunity.
Yeah. And as someone who's certified in mental health first aid myself, I can definitely speak to the value of that training and how it is becoming happily. I'm seeing it becoming much more prolific, just as companies conduct first aid training and AED familiarity, and now even things like Stop the Bleed training, mental health training and mental health first aid is something that's becoming part of the human resources track and training in many companies. And happily, once again, I think your organization, the Connecticut Business Leadership Network, is aptly stepping into the forefront here in saying, hey, it's okay for you companies, and it's a good thing, it's a positive and progressive thing to be bringing this into avail your workforce of the training.
I agree, and more companies are getting interested in that training, and more human resource professionals on their own are seeking out that training with or without the companies they work for, and that's very, very important. And that way, people within your businesses or within your community that need assistance can find it through people who are trained in mental health first aid.
Mm-hmm. So with this latest event now passed, which was actually entitled Inclusion Works Here, Creating an Inclusive Workplace from Recruiting to Retention, can you talk about some of the other points that resonated with you, Sharon, through the course of this talk that seemed to also pique the interest of audience members in terms of creating this overall inclusionary atmosphere that this series is working so hard to promote?
Well, I believe that the most important word is kindness. And I understand that might sound simplistic to some people and maybe not very businesslike, but it's a way of conducting yourself and looking at each individual within your workplace, each of your colleagues, each of the people who work with you through the lens of kindness. When you do that, you create a more inclusive atmosphere around you, and it's an atmosphere that has a tendency to grow. When you have a kind workplace atmosphere, you will create an atmosphere with people who are having difficulties and having mental health issues are willing to come out and discuss them. They're willing to come out and seek help. So having that kindness and understanding, I would say, would be a primary factor in creating a mental health-friendly workplace.
Very good. So let's talk for a moment or two about how this particular segment in your ongoing series addressed this need for members in the workforce and how you are helping businesses recognize this sort of untapped reservoir of talent?
We did two things, and Deborah did two really great things. First of all, she created two exercises or games, which gave people, and really added humor to it too, but gave people an idea of what it was like to have a mental health disability, in this case specifically schizophrenia, which is a very serious challenge to the individuals who have it, and what it is like to be able to function while hearing voices in your head and having those voices as interrupters in your daily life as you're trying to do the things that people would normally do. So we had an exercise in that. She also created a grid which compared the effect of certain mental health disabilities to certain physical disabilities. Mm-hmm. So that people would understand how these mental health disabilities would affect an individual's life and how we could help those individuals become more productive. So it's really, really important. What I liked about it is she spoke not only about the issue, but about a solution to the issue. And that is very important to me. I don't like to hear about a problem unless someone has also come up with a couple of creative ideas for a solution. And Deborah did that, and it was extremely helpful. She also had us talk about and recognize the talent of people with mental health disabilities, and that someone with a mental health disability has the ability to work and to really contribute to society and in the appropriate workplace to flourish and end up in greatness and do great things for that workplace.
Mm-hmm. As the workplaces in Connecticut become more inclusive, much in part and in thanks to the work that you're doing with the Connecticut Business Leadership Network in this Inclusion Works Here series, how much did this or any of the other prior three workplace events that you've held so far, how much did they help managers who may have been very, very accustomed to managing a predominant number of members of their workforce who didn't have or didn't have obvious or stated mental health issues? What kind of tools did this workshop or others in your series help to impart on managers as the amount of self-identifying workplace members are coming forward and revealing the fact that they are living with a mental health issue, or in managing a larger segment of their workforce that may require just a little bit more attention or a little bit more TLC, or at least a greater understanding of the conditions that make these people not only unique, but also valued members of their workforce?
First of all, we like to talk about in creating an inclusive workplace that we're really talking about an us, not a them. One of the things that we stressed in one of the initial programs regarding mental health, and we had one last year around this time, was the importance of understanding that we all have some kind of mental health issue. All of us experienced it on some level. All of us get anxious before, or at least most of us get anxious before we take an exam, before maybe it's time for our annual review, before we get married, et cetera, et cetera. And then when it comes to not only issues of anxiety, but all of us had sad things happen to in our lives. And all of us get sad over losing a loved one, over not doing well at work, or having failing at something, so to speak, that's important to you. So it is not a matter of those people being different. It's a matter of them being on a spectrum that is somewhat different than we are, because we are all in that situation. And hiring managers and coworkers, having a true understanding of that can make all the difference in the world.
Very good.
Because it makes people realize that people with mental health disabilities, where those issues become or can become interruptive or disruptive to their day and their functioning, when it gets to that point that they need to seek help, these people are really the same as you. And when you're looking at them, you are looking in a mirror. So it really is know them. Walgreens is a very inclusive workplace, and they have this symbol with the circle and a slash and the word them in it, meaning there's no them. There's only an us. Hmm. That is, I believe, the most important takeaway.
Very good. So in the last minute or so that we have with you, Sharon, what is next on the agenda for the Connecticut Business Leadership Network's Inclusion Works Here series?
Okay, well, we are going to be having our next meeting is on September 20th, and it is our annual meeting, where we'll be giving awards for inclusive workplaces and our disability-owned or our supply chain diversity initiative. We'll be doing that. And the meeting, we'll have our next meeting after that in November. If you want to see our list of meetings, you can see them on our website, on the first page of our website at www.ctbln.com.
Sharon Denson is Executive Director of the Connecticut Business Leadership Network, an affiliate of the U.S. Business Leadership Network, doing great work, as you can hear right here in Connecticut. We hope folks that are listening that are involved in human resources or leadership in their business circle can join with and take advantage and attend these workshops and meetings with the CTBLN. Once again, ctbln.com is the place to go. Sharon, thank you so much for visiting again, and we'll talk to you later in September. Have a great summer, and thank you once again for all the great work you're doing. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a PSA relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make a request for airtime in writing to me via email at john.voket, that's john.voket, at connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast without permission of Connoisseur Media. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scotts, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voket. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and important information on the award-winning For the People. Don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.